Tape 2, side 2, continued.
You tell us anything about what
is
he?
Fair,
yes.
Had this old master exhibition.
Which was what?
Called the Masterpieces of Art. Yeah, this is 39 and 40.
That's right.
1939-40. It was backed by the Marquis de Cuevas and had on his board people like Joe Devine and the whole art, milieu of New York and abroad. It was an exhibition of incredible paintings from all over the world, from the Rijksmuseum, from the National Galleries, from the Louvre, every place. It was Old Masters the first year. The second year contained Old Masters, but also went as late as up to about 1900, but not as much in depth, containing a lot of American paintings too. And this was the large show. 1939, they charged 50 cents admission, which was considerable. It's about $5 today, if not more. I would say more. It was a wonderful show, it really was. And I was a kid, when the thing was over, I was then assistant to the director. The first year, the director was Valentina from the Detroit Museum. Second year was Walter Pach, P-A-C-H, the man who was secretary of the famous Armory show. More important, he was married to a fabulous woman. Great big hulking Viennese, who is one of the most charming people I've ever known. It was, for me, an incredible time in my life because I was a kid, in a sense, although I was in my 20s. I was very well paid for the period, and the fair was an amazing sort of thing to work in every day. And it had a lot of excitement to it too. The second year, the board gave us an executive secretary named Rolf von Wegen. Not important, don't
think. Okay.
What a character. He was right out of central casting for any of the Nazi generals in Germany. And one day, I having been born in New Jersey, I know what Picatinny meant. You probably never heard of it.
No, what is the word?
Picatinny is the famous arsenal way out in the middle of the state where most of American munitions were gathered and not only stored, but made too. They weren't made out there, they were actually stored. And one Saturday I went into my office because I was going out looking at the fair with some friends. And there, the telephone rang, and this woman said, "Your call to Picatinny is, I can't make connections," or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, I didn't know about it." "All right, perfectly all right." About a few minutes later, Wegen walked in and said, "Was there any long distance calls for me?" And I didn't think of Picatinny as being a long distance call. And I said, "No." He seemed very upset. Sunday, they awoke to the news the Picatinny Arsenal had been blown up. So there went my first deal with the FBI. We also had two very, very, very French women who took care of our cloakroom to make sure nobody took canes or anything else into the exhibition. And these gals despised him with every bone in their body. And they began suddenly telling me stories about how all these packages were coming in and being picked up by strange looking people. There went the FBI again. Went throughout the whole thing. In the end, he was picked up. But that's one of the sidelines. You talk about fun. For a kid, it's fun.
For right now, looking back, it's scary.
It's horrible.
Yes.
And it was an ominous year. You saw the Russian pavilion was closed. All these things were happening gradually. And you prepared for the worst, that's all. We knew war was coming. Right after that, the corporation I was with sort of limped out of this and without very much to do and asked for an idea. And so a lot of my friends were Greeks for no reason other than
by chance.
Most of the dancers for this man, Stephane Bourgeois' wife, were Greeks. She was one of the Isadora Duncan dancers. And they got me all involved in Greek war relief. So one day I thinking, here, I got this problem. Stephane was my mentor. He hasn't any money. My corporation is practically broke. Well, I better think of something. And the whole thing evolved out, and 5 seconds later, I had it all down. We put on a Greek war relief exhibition of El Greco paintings at Nerdless in New York. I could only get 17 because of the war conditions. But we wore out their rugs. We made about $80,000 for that time.
Where was it?
At Nerdless on 57th Street. That's when they had that wonderful block of art galleries, long since passed.
What was the name?
KNOEDLER. They're still going. And that was a lot of money.
How did you get the El Grecos together? How did you get them together, the El Grecos?
What do you ask? There are quite a few El Grecos in this country.
And you just ask purpose?
I immediately got a committee together. We got that horrible woman called the Countess Mercati, who, wow, what a shrew. But she did it.
Okay.
She got on people. She was not Greek herself, but her husband was. And began getting people all the way through. And it was an incredible, the test of the whole thing was how long the line outside was. And went all the way down 57th Street. It was wonderful.
Yes.
And Stephane, I made him director of the show. We ran it. We made money on the catalog and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
From there on in, then I got a call from a man named Joseph E. Davies. Does that name mean anything to you? Joseph E. Davies was former director to a former ambassador to Russia.
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay.
And he was married to Mrs. Post, if I remember correctly. Well, yes, he was married.
Meriwether Post.
Yeah. And this really scared the bejesus out of me, I must say. I had not run into anybody of his ilk before. And he said, you ran that show? And I said, yes. He says, I'm all mixed up with this exhibition of I've got to put on something or other for the medical aid to Russia. Well, when you're dealing with Russia, you're in a scary position in a peculiar way. But he says, don't worry, he says, we've got Mrs. Roosevelt and Mrs. Churchill, and he went down the line all on the board, don't worry. And he said, and I have just to show, I have everything. Why don't you come up and see me? And I said, I'd be delighted to. So I went up to see him, his apartment on Park Avenue, or was it Fifth Avenue? I don't know. At any rate, and he had, when he was ambassador, he brought back from Russia all these copies. He had copies made of all the famous Ripen, R-I-P-E-M. He was the nearest thing to a Norman Rockwell painter of the 19th century, who did famous pictures like The Sultan's Reply to the Tsar. And, you know, they're all sort of dashing things. And he'd given all of these to, I think it was the University of Michigan, or was it Wisconsin, doesn't matter. And he said, these would be fabulous. We could send them all around the country. And I was young enough to say, no, I don't agree with you. I think it's a terrible idea. And he demanded to know why, and he said, because, I said, they're not good pictures. So, you know, as you get older, you learn how to be a little bit more diplomatic. And he was literally steaming. I don't blame him.
And, in retrospect.
And so he says, well, what would you do? I said, why don't you give me 1 week? And he said, okay, I'll see you such day at this time exactly on the moment, on the hour. And I came up there with, I think, one of the best programs I've ever made at any time. It was sensational.
What was it?
The great pictures of Russia were endangered because they were in Moscow. And the fighting was going, the invasion of was taking place of Russia, and my idea was to bring, didn't matter, if we could get 20, fine, if we get 30, better, and 40,
great,
but here are some of the great pictures in the world. Here's the fantastic, the greatest, to me, the greatest of all the Rembrandts, is the prodigal son. The father's out there, and the son is kneeling before him, and the father's hands are not quite on the son's shoulders. There's a little space between. But by God, there's electrical charge between those things. Incredible. I had a whole list of these things. Not only that, but how to get them out. We'd send them by air, and at that time, all of the newspapers are reporting that a hero of the Republic, so-and-so, had knocked down so many Nazi planes. And they all refer to these aviators as hero of the public. And I said, we'll get one of those guys, let him take it to Vladivostok, and we can, it can then go through Alaska. And I would ask for planes by the United States government to accompany it into New York. At that time, the Giovinezza building, the old, on Fifth Avenue, right across from the St. Patrick's Cathedral, there was the Italian Embassy. I don't know if you know these. There are two buildings there. One was British and the other was Italian. And they were built, actually, the Italian Embassy was almost an art gallery in itself. Just enormous long halls. I'll never forget, it had a big, long, incredibly long table, and in the middle of it was Ciano's book on how he dropped bombs on the Ethiopians and that wonderful spurt of red that came up and all that. And what a place to take over. How logical. And that's purely mechanics. Oh, we even had the idea of bringing in with troops, bringing in from the airport. And I was getting places with this, by the way. Don't believe me, it wasn't just a pipe dream. And because what's his name? A man I went saw, what did I just call him? The foreign ambassador, Davies.
Davies.
Had connections everywhere. This is no problem. And we could have gotten the entire thing. And then I pointed out what I really wanted to do. I said, the important thing here is medical aid to Russia. Not, let's forget about everything else. Let's charge only 25 cents. Let's have a line that goes down 30 blocks if necessary. And then we send it right through the country. What an incredible feat this would have been. But more than that, I said it would have galvanized all attention to this. But I did even went further. I talked to the Fifth Avenue Merchants Association and got all the stores interested in doing Russian gowns and that sort of thing, style, pushing them. Mm-hmm. They all became very interested. The Philharmonic was would perform several programs of Russian music. The opera was going to do Kovanchina, no, it was Boris and so forth. It was going to be a great deal, starting everything at once. What a wild idea.
Great.
But anyway, the whole thing, everybody got excited about it. We actually went, it went finally, I'm trying to think who was the ambassador there. Umansky was the ambassador to the United States. He sat on it.
Who was?
There's always one guy who wrecks an idea.
That name's not familiar.
Umansky was ambassador. I don't know how you spell it. O-U-M-A-N-S-K-Y. He replaced Litvinov. This is during Roosevelt's campaign. By the way, Mrs. Roosevelt was very excited about this. And by the way, I also had a possible, working with NBC. We were talking about the possibility, for the first time, having a broadcast. Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill. Can you imagine what that would be like? I must say, this is one of the best things I ever conceived of in my life. And actually, I'll never forget Davies that after that session. Obviously, I was pretty excited, and I got across to him. He was absolutely drooling. And we got it to Umansky. Umansky sat on it and finally sent it to Vox, V-O-K-S, which is the Russian cultural organization. And Vox finally approved it. But the next day, Moscow ceased to be the capital, and they went to Kubyshev. Remember when the Russian capital moved? And that was the end of the whole thing. And by that time, it didn't matter because I was already in the war.
That's a good step for us because you talked quite a bit about Iran and the war. But only about it from a military point of view. What can you tell us about the social situation in Iran while you were there?
Social.
First of all, when you're in the
military, you're not very involved with the social.
Day by day.
But I will say a lot of things. I've been writing about it at great length now.
That's a reasonable question.
The thing about Iran is it's a few people realize how miserable this world can be. And yet, if you want to see a situation that's almost as bad as Iran was, and all you have to do is go right down south of here to Haiti and see what it's like there. I've been in Haiti, and I want to tell you, it is just as miserable, except Iran is one of the most medically backward countries in the world. I have never encountered so much illness and disease in every form. Elephantiasis, I don't know if you've ever seen it, it's real worse. It's horrible. And yet it was common. You had whole cities of the blind. There's a city called Dizful, D-I-Z-F-U-L, which is referred to in, even in the Bible as the city of the blind, also as the city of rats, where people live. It's so hot down there, they live beneath the earth. They're blind anyway. God knows how half this survives. And you know what the blindness is from? It's not hereditary or anything else. It's trachoma. If you know anything about trachoma, it's just filth. That's all it did it. You'll see a mother walking along with a kid, and the kid's face, you can't find a face, it's just coated with flies. It's hard also to speak of the whole economic system there. I'm a little bit away, and it's funny, I always question my own memory about things. I forget it's the system of the 10th or the 7th. I don't remember. I think it's the 10th. The man that supplies the land gets 1/10. The man that supplies the water gets 1/10. The man that supplies the labor gets 1/10. The man that supplies the seed gets 1/10. The man who has the donkeys that help. Everything gets into this. And that's, so as you realize, the poor farmer who does this gets only 10% of his produce, which is not enough for him to live on. I'm just speaking of the poverty is astounding. I lived for a time in a city called Ahvaz, A-H-W-A-Z. I don't know if it's still down there. I think it was wiped out recently in the war between Iran and Iraq. The streets were hard. There's nothing. That people just threw the slops out the windows, and when you got enough people walking down below, it became very hard throughout the centuries. This is modern culture. Even in Tehran, the most European of all the cities in Iran, they have the Jubes, J-U-B-E. The Jube is a gutter. It's about 2.5 feet wide, and it's rather deep. Oh, it could be in some places as deep as about 5 feet, maybe 6. This is your water system. The houses on the side drew up the water from the gutter, and that's what you drank, and you bathed them. Incidentally, all the sewage went back into that too. So I'm giving you this is astounding. And a modern city, I'll venture to say it hasn't improved very much since then. The higher ground you lived in, the better you were. I mean, the palace was way up towards Mount Demavan, so that as a result, the water only flowed downward. The bazaar area where the poorest people lived was the water. I don't know if it ever was water. It must have been absolutely a porridge. I'm just giving you ideas of what this city was like. By the way, they had horses. They had, well, droshkies was the means of communication. It's pretty sad. Yes, I came down with amoebic dysentery, which is very serious. It's not a common thing. If I'd gotten another attack of it, I would have been sent home, because they don't take chances with it. After I got it, I was in Iran for about 6 months when I got it. My weight went down to 117. And it remained down there. I think I got to, by the time I came to, of all places, here, I was finally up to about 135 after all those years. It certainly changes your whole metabolism and everything else. I used to eat ravenously, and the one thing I could do that I love very much is every night before going to bed, I'd be down at Schraff's down the corner and get myself a banana split. And eat it with no compunction. Just put on weight. So on. But
what kind
you
of
speak food? About the social world.
That's
when I was there, the imams, whole religious society was totally ineffective, except in one way. You know, Americans are strangely nice people, especially when they're dealing with people who need help. And our doctors, now I'm not speaking of the first units over there, we set up our first hospital, took one look at the landscape and they couldn't help it. They would come back after a full day's work and they set up an outside clinic. And anybody that needed help would come there. And these fellows would work from, say, about 8 o'clock until midnight and more. And since we could not use military supplies, all of us chipped in, everybody chipped in. And we bought supplies, we got everything we could. They were making tremendous headway. The line would be over a mile long. And it's a really sad thing, taking care of one person after the other. No, they kept no records for them. They couldn't. Couldn't speak the language. But the diagnosis was there and all that, especially with children. And one thing they were cleaning up was trachoma at a fast rate.
It's not hard to do.
No, very easy. And it's just a dirty disease. But there are lots of things of its nature. And there were things they couldn't do. But this went on for about a month. I'll never forget the whole thing. It was very exciting in a way. It's horrifying, too. And suddenly, no line. It all disappeared.
What happened?
And see, I was over there originally as a civilian. And so I was head of personnel for the entire... This is a very large construction operation. We were building docks, railroads, roads for miles. And at any rate, I had access to a lot I could learn through nobody else could. So I put my men to work immediately to find out what in the world this is all about. And it quickly developed. The local sheikhs had gotten very upset. The sheikhs felt that the first thing you know, we were treating women. Cool. I'll talk about women in a minute.
Yeah.
They were treating women. We were improving the health of the people. And the next thing you know, they might want to read, might want to get some education. The sheikhs would lose all dominance. It's the only thing they had on the people. So they went to the mullahs, and the mullahs declared evil eye. Now you don't realize that evil eye sounds like a childish thing. There, it's terribly important. And to them, a person, everyone disappeared. It was sad, that was the end of that whole project. To talk about women. You see, we were dealing with where I was more Sunni rather than Shia. The Shia Muslims were north, mostly in the Tehran area and that sort of thing. But they were a higher, more intelligent group, educated group. you've got to know that Iran was the, basically, the official religion was Zoroastrianism.
Why didn't it?
Most people don't know that. And they, which is nothing but a very primitive idea of the light is good and darkness is bad. Ahura Mazda, Mazda lights, is the goddess, god of light. At any rate, just to tell you this, the lot of woman, women had absolutely no rights whatsoever. Absolutely none. They couldn't get a divorce. Their husbands could divorce them. And if they got divorced, they were lost. They had no place to go. The husband got the children. When they died, you know, women don't go up. They don't. Only men go upward. And if you're a good soldier, Allah.
End of side two, take two. To be continued on tape three.
The most beautiful woman in the world. But for women, I don't know what happens. They just don't, nothing happens. They have absolutely no